Well, welcome to Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. And my guest today, she enjoys an enviable life. To those who love rivers, canyon country, and adventure, I really believe this, Krista Sadler. Krista is an author, adventurer, wilderness guide, earth sciences educator, paleontologist, rafting guide, and general champion of canyon country and rivers. Krista has written several books about dinosaurs and one about the fossil history of the Colorado Plateau, titled Life in Stone. She's edited a book of boatman's stories that I really would like to read called There's This River, and is the owner of This Earth Press. Her articles and photography have appeared in Plateau Magazine, Plateau Journal, Sedona Magazine, Sojourns, and Earth Magazine. She's also done some work for National Geographic, or maybe was funded by National Geographic. She's traveled the world researching geology, fossils, and more. She's here to talk with us today. Actually, she's on the phone from North Carolina, but she lives in Flagstaff. She recently finished another book that's just out. It's called The Colorado, and it's about the history of human interaction with the Colorado River. Krista will be in the Roaring Fork Valley next week to talk about it, but right now she's on the phone. Welcome to the show, Krista Sadler.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I have not read your book yet because I only just heard about your visit to the valley a few days ago. But man, does it ever look wonderful. I mean, but before we get into that, I started off the show saying that you live an enviable life. And I think you're laughing.
Tiring life, I think.
Well, you know, from the outside, I think for a lot of people in Carbondale, it would be an enviable life, you know, because you're outside a lot and you're in the canyon country and you go to some exciting places. Did you prepare for this kind of life, or did it find you?
Oh, that's a great question. No, I think the only way that I prepared for this life was by being an incorrigible tomboy. I was an incurable tomboy. I mean, I was kind of the son my parents never had. Not that girls shouldn't be. I mean, you know, girls should be out there all the time. But I was definitely, in that day and age, I was more boyish. And I think that's the preparation I had, was just getting dirty all the time and being outside. And I just loved it. And and so I sort of fell into the life. It all kind of gelled for me when I took a river trip in the Grand Canyon as just a passenger on a 6-day motor trip. And I was just in my early 20s. And it was just sort of like the light from above hit me. This is what I want to be doing.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you what your first response was to this place, to the Grand Canyon, but you've already answered that. So it changed your life.
And that wasn't actually my first, my first trip to the Grand Canyon. I was, the first time I spent any time there, I was 12, and I took a mule trip down to Phantom Ranch for Thanksgiving dinner with my parents. And I remember picking up a little piece of granite and schist, a little tiny thing, and the ranger told me how old it was, and I, of course, immediately stuffed it in my pocket, and I just never got over the fact. Let's just clear it. You didn't hear that. Did I say that out loud? I couldn't get over the fact that it was this old, and I was just madly in love with the place. But of course, at that time, I thought, well, I'm going to come back and be a mule wrangler.
Okay, and spend your life on the Bright Angel Trail.
A little later. Exactly.
So I can imagine. 12-year-old on the Bright Angel Trail, writing Brighty. Did you read that book when you were a little kid? Brighty
of
the Grand Canyon.
Many times.
Right.
Yes, I did. And I still have my official mule wrangler certificate that. My mule's name was Leif. And he's probably long gone, but I still have my certificate. So.
And
the place captured me pretty early.
Yeah, it sounds like it. You know, what is it that you love most about the Grand Canyon, if you can pick one thing?
Oh, boy. Oh, my my gosh.
I mean, you've been river raft, you've been guiding there, you've hiked there, you've ridden mules there. I mean, it seems to me that you've, you know, you really know that place inside and out.
Well, I know it better than many and not as well as many. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's one of the things I love so much about it. And I guess I would just include the Grand Canyon in with every part of sort of canyon country, the Colorado mm-hmm. Plateau. It's just that I could never go anywhere else in the world and never see everything there is to see in that place. Mm-hmm. And, in the whole Colorado Plateau. And I just love the fact that there are always these wonderful mysteries and treats and just little gifts around every corner, sometimes really big gifts, mm-hmm. an amazing view or a little waterfall or just a place that you never could have imagined. And also I love the fact that the place takes not just Grand Canyon, but again, the whole canyon country, it takes effort. And because it takes effort to go there and to get to know it, I think that it asks more of you and it gives so much back for that effort.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of vague. I can't really say it's because of, the beauty or the geology or anything like that. But it's just, I like the fact that it doesn't give up its secrets easily. But when it does, those places are extraordinary.
Well, you have to develop a relationship with the place, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You do. And it's not, these aren't the kind of places you can just sort of go and, people think they can go and spend a day or a weekend. And you can certainly get a sense of a place mm-hmm. or just turn that first page of the book, mm-hmm. Of the introduction to the book. But you really have to spend some time in these places,
mm-hmm.
Which is probably the same with every place. I imagine that there might be somebody who grew up in West Virginia listening to this and saying, "Well, wait, that's how I feel about West Virginia."
Right.
And, I think any place requires an effort and that you have that relationship with it.
And I wonder if those relationships are in danger. I mean, just a little experience that has really nothing to do with the Grand Canyon, but I was driving into Carbondale today and noticed that, we've known for a while that a new grocery store is being built in town. And I looked to the right of the highway and it shocked me because I've been in this valley, in this area for decades, and I've always seen the field over there, and I've always heard the meadowlarks over there. And now it's turning into a grocery store. And I guess I was taken aback. People listening to this might be thinking, well, you knew it was coming, but I was taken aback because...
it's the seeing it.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought, man, everything is changing. I never thought I'd see this field, mm-hmm. built up. And I'm wondering if you feel that way about the Grand Canyon. There are a lot of threats to the Grand Canyon and that I've, I talked to Kevin Fedarko about and I'm wondering if you feel that place is vanishing, specialness.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of threats to Grand Canyon, fewer to Grand Canyon because it is a theoretically protected national park, fewer to the canyon than there are to other places that have less legal protection. But still, even in Grand Canyon, there are some threats. There are the threats of overdevelopment, threats of overdevelopment of water resources, uranium mining, things like that. I'll be honest with you, and this, again, I'm going to get a little vague, I suppose, but I think one of the biggest threats and one of the biggest changes, things that worries me the most I've been guiding in one form or another for about 35 years now, which is sort of astonishing and horrifying to me, because I still think I'm only 35.
I hear
but,
you.
But I get the sense that we are losing our connection with the planet, In a in a way that, you know, we kind of are seeing, we see the planet as what can we get from it? And to a certain extent, humanity has always done this. But even now, even to the point of, say, recreation, I mean, recreation is becoming incredibly sort of commodified and and in some ways it feels a little, you could almost say a little extractive.
Oh, really? You think it's, what do you mean by that? Extractive recreation.
Well, just
that's
that,
great.
Well, just that people go with this idea that they're going to come back with a certain experience, and not everyone. This is, I'm obviously, you know, oversimplifying a bit, but you know, there's the, whether it's the I've got to get that photo that I've seen in this Instagram account, or, you know, in that postcard or whatever, or I have to have this experience. I'm going to go and I'm going to, whether it's, you know, check it off or however you want to describe it. But I don't know that people are, I think we're losing a connection with the planet that we need to have simply because the planet exists, and simply because these places exist. And this is exactly what Wallace Stegner said many, many years ago. So I'm certainly not the first person to think about this. But he is, you know, very famously said, we need to keep these places protected, even if we never do more than drive to their edge and look in. Or if we never once in, you know, 10 years or in our lives go visit them. And I know there are places around the planet. I may never get to Patagonia. It's one of the places I've always wanted to go, and I've never been. But I am so happy to know that there is a national park there, that there are people trying to protect that, those resources and those places, simply because they have every right to exist. And we're losing our ability to see the value in these places unless we can get something from them. And maybe it's, you know, if it's just recreation, maybe that's not as damaging as, you know, a coal mine or an oil well or, you know, something like that. But I think that if we lose a generation of people, I mean, if we're losing these people who care about these places simply because they exist and they deserve to be cared about, that worries me a lot, because those are the people that are going to go, you know, into the courts and become politicians and start managing our, you know, our society in future years. And that's what worries me a lot, and that manifests itself in all of these other threats, the uranium mines or things like that.
Right, and that's really interesting. I can understand exactly what you're talking about. And I worked for environmental organizations many years ago, including Sierra Club here in the Valley, and it was at a time in the 80s and early 90s when environmentalists were trying to sort of put a value and convince politicians and the powers that be of the value of wild lands. And in my opinion, this is my opinion only, it seems that the recreation industry, which seems like an odd combination of words, the recreation industry is one way that has manifested. I mean, you said it isn't as hard on the landscape as, or as bad as uranium mining or coal mining or oil and gas drilling or whatever. But maybe it's gotten a little out of hand. I mean, I know that some environmentalists really use the figures that come from, you know, how the outdoor industry is benefiting the state's economy, and that's a good thing. But if it turns into extractive recreation, I mean, how good is it really?
Well, yeah, and it's a really complex, I mean, this is such a huge gray subject. There is absolutely no black and white. You know, personally, I would prefer to see recreation than, you know, than the true extractive industries on these lands. But I think it has, part of it is more of an attitude than the actual uses. I mean, a lot of people say, well, you have to get people out onto these lands to appreciate them, to be able to protect them. And absolutely that is true. People are going to have a hard time protecting what they haven't seen. But why is that? To me, that's the big question. Because why can't we protect a place that we've never seen? And is that just a uniquely human thing, or is that, you know, I mean, I would love to fight for the lands in Patagonia if I were needed, even though I may never see them.
Well, I feel the same way about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah, it's another place I spend a lot of time.
Oh, really?
And that is another place I work up there in the summers.
Oh, wow.
I think it has as much to do with an attitude as with the action itself.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see people come to these places and instead of saying, that was a waste of time because I couldn't do this or do that,
sure.
or that it was raining the day I was supposed to do my river trip, or, you know, whatever. Or looking at a piece of land as a piece of wilderness as useless if I can't go there and recreate on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard because these are more attitude changes that I would love to, or just an attitude that I would like to see us foster and try and go back to. I mean, the people who fought to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and people like Wallace Stegner, you know, they respected the land simply because it existed, and they actually, you know, they didn't necessarily want a lot of people to go see it because they wanted to protect it in as pristine a situation or as pristine a condition as possible. So it's a real conundrum, and I don't claim to have any answers. I am actually talking to the Youth Summit, Youth Water Summit. Those participants, we're going to have a little discussion about this very thing because they've been spending the last, you know, however long studying various aspects of the planet and of the watershed, and I really want to talk to them and sort of raise this question with them and say, how do we make people care about something they've never seen, may never see, may never give them anything? But how do we get them to care? Because that's the generation that, you know, this is the next generation that really needs to be thinking about this, and I hope we'll think about it. So I'm interested to see what they say.
Yeah, me too. I want to remind listeners, it's 4:48, and this is Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, and my guest today is Krista Sadler, who's an author, an adventurer, a wilderness guide, a reincarnation of David Brower. No, I'm just kidding. Earth scientist.
No.
maybe Wallace Stegner. No. She's a rafting guide and a general champion of canyon country and the Grand Canyon and rivers. You know, we're rapidly running out of time, unfortunately. But I've been really enjoying this conversation. You're going to be in the Valley next week, speaking in Aspen and in Carbondale, about your book, the new book, The Colorado, about the history of human interaction with the Colorado River, something that's extremely beloved to all of us here. John Wesley Powell, you devote one of the 9 chapters in the book to John Wesley Powell, and if I'm understanding correctly, your talks up here are going to focus on him, who is ironically the namesake of Lake Powell. Can you talk about him briefly? I mean, why is he so important to understanding water in the West?
Yeah, well, thank you for the introduction to the, you know, the book and the talk. Powell, so yeah, this is next year is the 150th anniversary of his first journey down through the Grand Canyon on the Colorado River, and that's kind of what a lot of people know him for. It's almost as though he kind of did that river trip and then disappeared into history. But he really had a long and very storied career after that. And what I really would like to talk about is his ideas for how the West should be settled. He really was prescient, and he saw exactly where we are right now 150 years ago.
No kidding.
There's a great quote of his that appears in the show about, you know, you're piling up a heritage of conflict and litigation. There is not enough water in this country. You know, that's a paraphrase of it, but he really saw this, and he had the unique ability, well, maybe not unique, but he had the ability to look at the land and see it for what it was, which is something that very few people at the time and even now can do. Certainly the politicians and the land speculators and the railroad folks, you know, if they saw it, they didn't want to believe it because they figured they could just make a lot of money off of it. And Powell, who was really a pure scientist, I mean, he just did science and saw, you know, he took what he saw and he took his observations and he took his conclusions and was able to look at things really holistically. And so that's what I kind of want to talk about is just, you know, a little bit obviously about his journey and who he was and his background, but talk about some of that and then bring it up to the present and kind of look into the future in terms of how can we begin to see our landscapes and our watersheds holistically. And I know that there's a lot of great work being done there in your valley with your water conservancy. And so if this isn't at all a recipe for how do we fix this, because I am not a water policy expert at all, and there are a lot of good people working on this at the policy level, but what are some things that we as just individual citizens can either do or just ways that we can sort of change our thinking about water?
What do you mean by holistically?
You mean with Powell? He had a really remarkable ability to combine aspects of a lot of different sciences, geology, you know, botany, or not archaeology, ethnology. And so he sort of looked at things from a lot of different perspectives, but he was able to really look at the land and see it in its entirety. He didn't just look at a single part of it and say, well, this we can do this with, and never mind the rest of it, which might make that challenging. But, you know, we'll just work with this. He looked at the whole thing. And so he really had a much more holistic and realistic sort of vision of the West.
It's sort of like a systems
almost anyone
thing.
Else.
Mm-hmm. He looked at it systemically,
exactly.
I guess, is the word I want.
Yes, yeah, he did. Mm-hmm. He saw it as a whole system, and he mm-hmm. recognized that it was all related. He had a beautiful vision, which I'll talk a lot about in the presentation, about how we should settle the West. And of course, it didn't get adopted. But you always wonder what would have happened if his idea had been adopted. The West might be a very different place now.
Well, you know, we have about 3 minutes left. Can you believe it? And I'm wondering if you can give us like a brief rundown, just a brief, you know, synopsis of what his vision was.
Well, oh boy, brief.
Yeah, you have 10 seconds. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, he proposed that the West be settled in watershed commonwealth. So not in with straight lines, you know, dividing up states and counties and all of that, these straight lines we have that do not take any natural features into account. He proposed, he divided the West into, it was over 100, I think it was about 125 watershed commonwealths. And that each commonwealth, each watershed would be responsible for its own water, and that the different divisions of these districts, these watershed districts, would work cooperatively to provide the goods, the resources, and the water that each section needed. So it was a really far-thinking perspective.
Yes.
on how the West was different from the East, mm-hmm. and why you needed to settle it differently.
Well, that's really interesting. That's something I didn't know about him. And I just want to let listeners know that Krista Sadler speaks Wednesday, November 14th at 6 p.m. at the Pitkin County Board of County Commissioners Meeting Room in Aspen, and again in Carbondale on November 15th at 6 p.m. at the 3rd Street Center. The events are free. Krista, will you have books there? Will you have copies of The Colorado there?
I will have copies of The Colorado, yes. I hope everyone can make it out. And it's a really interesting subject. I think it's a very timely subject.
Oh, yes.
For a lot of reasons. And yeah, I hope to see everyone out, and I hope you can make it too.
Yes, I would like to. And I, you know, because when I look at these chapter names, and I know we've only got a minute left, so I can't ask you another question, unfortunately. But the chapter names of these nine chapters, it just, you know, it's like, is this an update of Cadillac Desert? You know, I mean, it's looks like this is something that I think people who are interested in water really need to read. So, Krista Sadler, thank you so much for a great conversation. I wish we had another half an hour. And we will see you next week, Wednesday, November 14th in Aspen, and November 15th at 6 in Carbondale at the 3rd Street Center. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.